I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. And Boston, there's pretty much no question about it, is a college town. It's a town that's brimming with students and the scholars that teach them and the leafy campuses that house them. But beyond the bricks and the ivy, there are clearly problems. The best-selling author Seth Godin recently told me that he worries that college is too often a repeat of high school, but with a lot more binge drinking. And even if your college experience is a lot more worthwhile than that, is it worth north of $55,000 a year, which is what so many private schools are now charging? Or are we witnessing a kind of revolution in the way that college is structured? Well, joining me to answer those questions are Andrew Delvanco, professor of American Studies at Columbia and the author of College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. Daphne Kohler, professor of computer science at Stanford and a founder of Coursera, which offers free online courses. And Pratik Tandon, an economist at the World Bank. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Nice to be with you, Kara.
And Andrew Delvanco, I'm going to start with you. You talk in the opening pages of your book about a 25-year-old effort to keep Columbia's admissions need blind. And I wonder, do you think the expense of college has gotten out of control? I was looking at Columbia this morning, since that's where you are. It looks like it's about $61,000 a year when you factor in tuition, room and board, the fees that are required, and books.
Look, nobody would deny that we have a college cost problem in this country, but it's a complicated problem, and usually the sound bites don't quite capture the complexity. First of all, at a place like Columbia, roughly half the students are getting a discounted price, which we call financial aid. So the sticker shock is a little bit misleading. Secondly, it's true we have a big student loan problem in this country, but a lot of it is a result of the growth of the for-profit sector in higher education in recent years. And thirdly, the institutions where tuition is going up most rapidly are the public institutions, and that's a function of the fact that public funds are being withdrawn from the support of our state universities and colleges, and so the cost is being transferred to students. So I'm not denying that we have a problem, but it's a complicated one, and we shouldn't necessarily conclude that we're charging luxury prices for a defective product.
Right. Well, let me follow up on that topic of state schools. And as you say, they have gotten so much more expensive in recent years. And that was, for a lot of people, the option for the middle class, for the lower middle class. Do you worry that because of, you know, Medicare and Medicaid and moving money more towards elderly populations, that we are shortchanging the college-age population who need those state schools?
Absolutely. I think we should all be worried about that. And people, creative people like Daphne, are trying to think about solutions to that problem. But I think, again, it's a complicated problem that requires a number of different approaches. But there's no doubt about the fact that this is at the center of the resource allocation debate that should be a part of our politics. I mean, you know, how do we prioritize among serving the poor, which is certainly very important, serving the elderly, and serving young people who need an education more and more urgently in our global knowledge economy?
Daphne Kohler from Stanford, I want to ask you a little bit about how Coursera got started. It's a company that, as the New York Times recently pointed out, got more followers more quickly than Facebook or Twitter, and you've got really big institutions, MIT, Stanford, University of Virginia, Johns Hopkins, offering free courses. How did you decide? Here you are at this, you know, normal institution, sort of traditional institution, Stanford, to go so outside the box here.
Well, so my co-founder Andrew Ng and I have been working in online education in our roles as Stanford instructors for about 4 or 5 years now, and we realize that the kind of educational experience that we offer to our on-campus students in large lecture classes is something that is actually better packaged in an online medium, because it actually provides a more interactive and engaging format than sitting in a 300-person auditorium listening to the lecture talk at you. And so we decided to try and provide that better educational experience simultaneously, both to our on-campus students, but also open up the kinds of really high-quality education that has been available only to a tiny sliver of the world's population to everyone around the world. And I think the real revolution here is our ability to offer that kind of education at a marginal cost per student, which is effectively zero. That is, by exploiting technology, by leveraging that, we can now offer that kind of education for considerably less than a dollar a student. And since we all realize that education is the great equalizer and that the only path forward to a better life in most cases is via an education, I think this is a tremendous opportunity to affect positive change in the world.
And when you went to MIT initially, to Caltech, to all these places, and you said, hey, do you want to offer a free online course? Let's take some of your best professors and have them offer their absolute best lectures. Did they pick you up immediately on that, or did they say, why would we do that? People are paying $50,000, $60,000 to come to our school.
Well, I think all of the institutions that are working with us and as well as with other organizations to offer these online courses realize that the education that they offer to their on-campus students is not the same as what's being offered in these online medium, because what you get for the on-campus experience is that one-on-one interaction with the instructor, that network of peers that you can mind meld with and brainstorm with and do creative problem solving and so on. So I think, in fact, for most of our institutions, they're viewing this as a way of opening up more time in the curriculum for that kind of interpersonal interaction at the expense of the more more mundane, if you will, conveyance of content, which has been the bread and butter of college education in most colleges up until now. Hmm. And so, in fact, it's an advantage to them to do this.
Pratik Tandon from the World Bank, I know you've looked at the way that other countries view our college system and in some ways try to imitate it, but in some ways are trying to, you know, maybe compete with it. And I wonder how important and how much of a game changer is something like Coursera or Khan Academy, which Salman Khan started, same idea, also diffuses free information, free lectures. How much is that changing things in the developing world?
Well, I think these types of online platforms have great potential. They, as you mentioned, reach huge audiences, and they can deliver access to the best knowledge and the best professors around the world. But I think it's also a bit early in the game to evaluate these on a very rigorous basis. But there are two things that stand out to me is that first, students around the world, they want degrees and they want accredited bachelor's degrees, master's degrees and the like. And the extent to which they can sign up for a lecture class and watch a fantastic professor give a lecture, that's fantastic and great for their learning, but it'd also be helpful if they can get credit for that through their current college or university where they're enrolled around the world. So there's a need for some more interaction among these accreditation bodies and the universities. The second thing, I think it will be very interesting to see how this type of service delivery plays out over the medium term and how it compares against the outcomes of traditional college and university service delivery, particularly in terms of the skills that the students get. Are they developing critical thinking skills, their problem-solving skills, their communication, their teamwork, in addition to the technical knowledge that they're getting? And the bank has seen around the world in a number of different countries that there are numerous examples of skill shortages in very large countries where employers, looking from the labor market perspective, want students who have better foundational skills than what they currently have in their firm, their leadership, their communication, their teamwork. So I think an interesting point will be to see how these types of alternative platforms can also help address that challenge too.
Let me go back to Daphne Cole for a minute on this mm-hmm. question. I wonder, to what degree are the students that you're getting at Coursera from the U.S., and to what degree do they just want an education from Johns Hopkins or Caltech, but may not be from the U.S. at all?
So actually, I'd like to speak to two parts of this. So about a third of our students are within the United States, and two-thirds are international. They are spread all over the world, in India, in Russia, in Brazil, in China, but really all over the world, including Africa. And so I think there is a real hunger for this educational experience everywhere. Second, a very large number of our students are actually already educated and have degrees and are looking to just improve their job skills so that they're more employable. And so I think that there is a tremendous value to providing a continuing educational experience, because one of the things that we're seeing right now is that the world is very complicated and is changing very fast, and the education that you got in college 20 years ago might not be enough for what you need right now. And you can think of this as a way of keeping people current and employable and gainful for a much longer duration. So while I completely agree with the importance of degrees, and we're working also on accreditation for some of these courses, I think that one needs to think of education considerably more broadly.
Andrew Delbenko, let me go back to you. Do you get the sense that people at Columbia, your colleagues, it could be Columbia or elsewhere, are looking over their shoulder a little bit at these new sites like Coursera or Khan Academy, or Harvard and MIT have a partnership in edX? And are they thinking, whoa, a real revolution could be coming to college education?
Well, you use the word revolution. The president of Daphne's University, Stanford, President Hennessy, uses the word tsunami. Yes, I think there is an anxiety that something unpredictable and scary and potentially transformative would be the positive way to put it, destructive would be the negative way to put it, is on its way. And, you know, a funny thing about faculty, and I guess I qualify as a representative of that species, is that while faculty tend to be politically rather liberal by and large, they also tend to be sort of institutionally quite conservative. And so, yes, I think faculty are wary of what this means. A place like Columbia is not likely to be upended anytime soon, because there are many, many more students who want to come to our university than we can admit. But there are other institutions where it's a struggle each year, very good institutions, where it's a struggle each year to fill the entering class. And of course, therefore, there's an anxiety about whether, if I could put it this way, that the new technology will be supplementary in the way that Daphne just described it can be, or whether it will be substitutional in the sense that it will take over the functions of the traditional college and conceivably drive some institutions out of business, or at least have a suppressive effect on the number of faculty whom those institutions hire.
What do you think of this idea that Daphne talks about of sort of flipping the classroom, the idea of, you know, maybe getting the best lecturers in the world? And I remember several months ago talking to Walter Lewin, who's sort of a legend at MIT, one of the very first people to tape his physics lectures and just put them out there on the web. And it ended up that actually millions of people watched them. But taking the very best people in the country, no matter where they are, no matter who they are, and having people watch them on their own time at home, and the college classroom then becomes something very different. It becomes a discussion group, or it becomes somewhere where you get helped with your homework. What do you think of that?
Well, look, there's something to this idea that we're engaged in a very inefficient form of information transmission right now, where we put a lecturer in front of 200 or 300 or 400 or sometimes more students. And especially with today's generation of students who tend to be up all night and they get most of their contact with the world online already, it seems a very awkward and antiquated way of transmitting information. So the idea of flipping the classroom, as the phrase goes, and that is finding a better way to transmit the information and then and opening up the classroom for a higher order activity of discussion and debate and analysis, in principle, it's fine. But a few provisos occur to me. The really great lecturers already engage in an interactive kind of relation with their students. For example, Robert Reich out at Berkeley, whom I heard because my daughter was serving as a TA in his class on wealth and poverty, is an absolute master at engaging about 800 students in such a way that everybody feels as if they're in a seminar. Or Michael Sandel, whose course, famous course on justice at Harvard, has just gone up on edX, has always had a dialectical or dialogue form of teaching, even if he has large numbers of students.
Yes.
So I would say that the best teachers don't make this distinction between transmitting information to passive absorbers and engaging in discussion. The best teachers do both at the same time. So I'm not quite comfortable with this distinction between what we do now and what we might do with a new technology.
Daphne Coy, did you want to get in here?
Yes, I did. And I completely agree with Andy that, you know, there are some really amazing lecturers out there that can manage to engage a room full of 400 people. But that is a small minority, and I think Andy will agree with that. Most of the students that go into our large lecture halls today do not get that kind of quality experience. And I think by flipping classrooms and basically forcing people to spend the time engaging with their students and opening up enough time so that they can do that without the feeling like they're not covering the material and so that students won't be able to do the homework, I think that really opens up a new form of teaching that if you think about it, goes back to teaching the way it should have been or was many, many years ago when we could afford to teach sections of 10 or 15 people.
Pratik Tandon, let me come to you, because I think one of the, at the same time as we're watching college change, I think one of the big anxieties in the country is that we are also watching simultaneously the rise of particularly India and China, and huge numbers of people moving into the class, wanting the middle class, wanting college educations. What do India and China see when they look at our educational system? Do they still value it, or do they think, you know, really, this is too expensive, it's kind of bloated, it could use some reform?
Well, I think the U.S. system is and remains the envy of the world in its higher education system. India, China, a number of other countries around the world, I think, place a value and recognize the value of having a diversity of institutions that have different mandates. Of course, those two countries are looking to develop their premier world-class research universities. But other countries that may not be in a position to develop those types of research universities because they command a lot of resources, they're also looking at other avenues to support their emerging demand for skills in their big middle-class population. So they're looking to the private sector to support their system expansion and system diversification. And they're also looking at other types of institutions like the community college system in California, for example, and its ability to provide multiple pathways to access, the way that it can cater to non-traditional students, the way that it can provide flexible means of entry and exit. So there is certainly around the world a move towards more of these tiered systems like we have in the United States. But that being said, these countries also, they want to innovate. They want to see what works best for them. And so they're experimenting with a lot of new things, particularly in terms of how their public institutions are managed. They're getting a lot more autonomy for their public institutions. So their institutions have a lot more freedom over their budgeting, over their staffing, over the curricula. But at the same time, governments are demanding a lot more accountability. So they are putting a finer emphasis on these measures of external quality assurance. So they're mandating, for example, the research outputs of all universities are publicly disclosed, or the graduation rates, or the labor market outcomes, and the like, in a way to give students more clear and transparent information.
Just going to ask, are there innovative things that you think we should be learning from some of the countries that you're talking about that are really working on creating a premier higher education system?
Sure. I'll mention two. So the first I'll mention is in regards to financing, and particularly looking at these perhaps strategic objectives that is for a country. If a country wants to jump up the income ladder and increase its research capacity or technological capacity or the like. So in this economic climate, as you mentioned before, that public resources to universities are declining. There's probably little leeway to increase the volume of resources going to them. So countries are turning away from these historically negotiated budgets for their institutions. So an institution can't go to a government in some places anymore and say, this is how much we got last year. We adjusted it for inflation. We want to do a few other activities, and this is our new budget. So that that system is slowly changing. And around the world, countries in Singapore, Hong Kong, they're moving towards more performance-based financing systems. So in that situation, governments and institutions agree on a set of performance indicators, and all or part of formula funding is based on those indicators. So institutions are paid on the basis of their graduation rates or their research outputs or the number of students who graduate with certain skills, like in medicine in Hong Kong, for example.
So do you worry at all that judging graduation rates or judging how many people get a job, you know, having that kind of metric is breaking it down too fine, and people will stop majoring in, I don't know, the humanities, or, you know, they'll stop worrying about philosophy or American studies or English because they might think, sure, well, that's not a bankable enough thing to major in.
If I could jump in on this for a moment,
sure.
I mean, we're actually in our country already beginning to see this, right? In the state of Florida, for instance, I don't know if they've passed this legislation yet, but there's a lot of talk about actually charging more for less remunerative majors. So that is to create a disincentive for students to study some of the kinds of subjects that you've just mentioned. And while I agree that we really should hold ourselves accountable for what our students learn, when you get into the territory of performance-based evaluations, you have to go back to the question of what kind of performance are you evaluating and how. If you evaluate the value of a degree or a major based on the income of the graduate 2 years out of college, that'll tell you one thing. If you evaluate it on the basis of how that person leads his or her life and what kind of socially worthwhile work he or she may be doing 20 years out of college, you may come to a different conclusion. So these kinds of numerical metrics, which I think are coming, they seem to be inevitable, I think they do pose a real challenge to what we traditionally think of as a liberal education, a broad education.
I'm Kara. Here. I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and we're talking with Andrew Delbanco from Columbia, Daphne Kohler from Stanford, and a founder of Coursera, and Pratik Tandon from the World Bank. And Pratik, let me go back to you, and you can tackle that question.
Sure. I totally agree with what was just said. It's a very complex question, a very tricky question. And, of course, there are many different functions of higher education, of the generation and transmission of knowledge, of the socialization of students, of service to the community, of solving these global public problems, the kind of moral instruction that happens between students and instructors. And so a key question is trying to get this balance right overall as a system for a given country. And how to ensure that higher education is fulfilling its core mission. You know, Cardinal Newman wrote very elegantly about this, the idea of university. And sometimes there is, I think, a danger towards moving to too much of an economic perspective and an economic lens in evaluating the performance of institutions. And so it's up to every country and every system to strike the right balance. And unfortunately, there's no blueprint, there's no model, there's no formula to follow. But there's different experiments and innovation that can be tried.
And I know you told me that Hong Kong, for example, is offering a premium for schools that turn out doctors because, frankly, they don't have enough doctors.
Right. So there are in some countries there, national strategic objectives. The countries are looking at these different financial policies to try to set the incentives such that their performance is achieved. So in Hong Kong and doctors, and I think last week or 2 weeks ago, North Carolina announced a tuition freeze or free tuition for students who are going to study in certain scientific fields because they want to get more students involved in their STEM fields. So these types of incentive setting mechanisms happen a lot, but the danger is taking it to an extreme, and there is this constant challenge of reconciling these technical considerations with these larger political imperatives and the questions about the mission of a university.
And I want to ask Daphne Koller about this, but first, Andy Dumpenko, let me pose a question to you that comes right from your book, College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. You have a paragraph where you say, soon after taking office as Harvard's president in the winter of 2007, Drew Faust challenged the first graduating class to which she spoke at commencement to reflect on why nearly 60% of men in the previous year's class and over 40% of women took jobs in what is euphemistically called financial services. So I wonder if this is already happening to some degree.
It is happening. It probably slowed down a little after the reversals of 2007 and 8, and students are marking time before they go into the financial services. But yes, it is happening, and I think it's a symptom. It's not that there aren't very many good people who are, devote their lives to investing other people's money and then do good things with it. I prefer not to make generalizations about how people choose to lead their lives. But there does seem something a little off when close to two-thirds of the, at least the male students at our flagship university, are headed straight to Wall Street and don't have the imagination to think of some other way of leading a productive life. So I think the money culture in general, which is pretty pronounced in our country, has made inroads into higher education in the last quarter century or so, such that we've never seen anything like it before.
And Daphne Koller, what do you think of this incentive-based structure, whether it be in Florida, in North Carolina, in Hong Kong, at Harvard, wherever?
Well, so to some extent, I think one needs to have a more nuanced view of this, because on the one hand, I think it is important to give people the kinds of skills that will make them employed. And we read reports of people who got a major their degree in some humanities major and are now baristas at a coffee shop because they can't get a job. And so I think in setting up an incentive structure that gives people a chance at a better life is a valuable thing, although I think it's important to factor in the, I don't think financial services is the place where we want to send our graduates. There's plenty of, I think, important areas where we want to have more people graduating, whether it's medicine or STEM or similar disciplines. That said, from my own experience, we see a tremendous hunger for the kinds of skills and knowledge that a liberal arts education can give you. So in that respect, for example, our single largest class right now on the Coursera platform is a philosophy class. It's called Learn How to Think and Reason and Argue from Duke University, and has 175,000 people enrolled. And while that is certainly a very impressively large number, we see very robust enrollments in most of our humanities classes. And I think that indicates that one should have a balance between the kinds of skills that would give you a good job, but also at the same time leaving enough space in the curriculum for the kind of education whose values just to expand one's mind and maybe make you a better citizen.
And I wonder if there is some kind of imbalance between what is offered and what people do end up majoring in and what is needed. I remember talking to Marissa Mayer last year. She was then at Google, but she's now CEO of Yahoo. And one of her main concerns that she really emphasized is kids are not going into computer science at nearly the numbers that they need to. And Daphne, I'll ask you about that because, of course, you teach computer science. But is there a mismatch between what we educate people in and what we need people to do?
I mean, there is clearly a mismatch, and it starts in school, in middle school or even in elementary school, where I think the way in which we teach people doesn't motivate them to study the disciplines in math and engineering and computer science that are so critical to our economy. And I think this is partly because many of the teachers who teach these disciplines are not actually trained in those disciplines. An embarrassingly small fraction of teachers who teach math and science, certainly in elementary school, but even in middle school, are actually trained in those disciplines. And so it's hard to excite passion for a topic that you yourself are not passionate about. And so I think it's really important that we set up a much better pipeline, starting in elementary school and going all the way up, to encourage people and incentivize them to graduate in those disciplines that are so important to our economy.
I'm interested in what all of you think about this, but I'll start with Daphne. Do you think we're going to get to a point where you can take online courses, you can know, let's say, how to code, how to do computer code, and you may not need to ever really show up in a classroom if you can take a test, if you can prove to somebody, I may not have been to a university in the traditional sense, but I know how to do this thing and I can do it really well. Are we going to get to a point where that person can, you know, get a certificate, get a job?
Well, I think that we need to distinguish two aspects of this. The first is whether you can do this online, and the second is whether you can abolish the notion of a degree altogether. So there's very worthwhile, highly respectable degree programs right now that are fully online, that are competency-based, where people have outstanding job prospects when they graduate. And you know, Western Governors, for example, is one institution that has really took this notion of competency-based education to its full form, and their graduates are doing wonderfully in terms of job placement. So that's one aspect of this. I think a subtext of your question, though, is can we get rid of degrees altogether? That is, can someone get a certificate here and a certificate there and eventually get a job? And while I think that, you know, certainly there are cases where that might happen, I firmly believe in the importance of a degree because it's at one of those cases where the whole really is bigger than the sum of the parts. That is, it's important to have a deeper and more holistic view of a discipline so that you can go ahead and become an expert in that. And I certainly see that as we talk to employers, for example, regarding this revolution in education that we're experiencing, I hear very few of them saying, oh, let's abolish degrees altogether and just look at a pile of certificates from a variety of different courses.
And yet, Pratik Tandon, I mean, we see people like Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg celebrated, and people do not incidentally mention, and they didn't leave their institution with a degree. So do you see, either in the U.S. or elsewhere, a time coming when people will be able to get degrees or certificates or prove their knowledge, essentially, in some other way than what we've got now?
I don't. I know Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, they're very much the exceptions rather than the norm. They're very incredible, special people. But, you know, as Daphne said, degrees matter. And the work that the bank has done over the last several years in looking at labor markets and talking to employers and employees is that indeed degrees matter. But also things like their skills, their cognitive skills, but also their non-cognitive skills also matter in terms of their employability. So employers, regardless of what sector it is, also want potential workers who can think critically, who can solve problems, who can work in teams, who can communicate well, both orally and in writing. And, finding out, you know, a potential employee and finding out whether or not they have those skills is more than just looking at a certificate and seeing a demonstrated competency. And so at the end of the day, I think it just means, you know, more education doesn't automatically translate into better skills and better lives. There's more to it than that.
And Andy Delvenko,
well,
what do you see?
If I could say, I mean, I think there's a perception at the heart of our conversation, which I think we all share and I agree with, that is that there's a disconnect between the credential that a person may hold, or often is a disconnect, and the knowledge or skills that they may possess. When I started graduate school, a very great teacher said to me and my peers, look, you've got two things to do in graduate school. One is to get a PhD degree, and the other is to get an education, and they have almost nothing to do with each other. And I think that's often true. So I'm actually inclined to think that Daphne's vision of the future, where the degree will become less significant and tell you less, is likely to be accurate. But the other thing I would say about the conversation, and I say this in the context, I want to say it again, I really believe that Daphne is a person of great idealism, and the vision that she's putting forward is an exciting one, which is based on very admirable premises. At the same time, this entire conversation has been about education as something instrumental, something that leads to something else. except for, take that back, when Daphne spoke about continuing education, I completely agree with her. But most of what we've been saying is we need to reshape the education system so that the graduates can get to a goal of employment or financial self-sufficiency or whatever it may be. Of course, that's important, but that's only a part of what education has always been and, in my view, always should be, which is also the experience of the expansion of the mind and the imagination, including the moral imagination. And these are things that are immeasurable, and I remain skeptical and a little dubious about how well we'll be able to pursue those ends online.
But do you... Yeah, Daphne, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to speak to that, because I think that there is a certain assumption that many people have that there are certain kinds of cognitive skills or metacognitive skills that just can't be done online, communication skills, problem solving, critical thinking, and so on. And I don't think we have the basis for saying that. Now, I think it's something that we would have to develop the right technology, the right social network capabilities for students to interact in meaningful ways with each other and so on. But especially today's students get so much of their social interaction in an online medium anyway. I mean, they prefer to text each other rather than get together for coffee, that I think it's not impossible and, in fact, quite reasonable to expect that they'll be able to develop collaboration skills, problem-solving skills in an online medium if it was structured correctly. And we're already seeing that. So some of our courses have a really spectacular final project that students work on either alone or together, get feedback from their peers, and we've seen some tremendous things come out of that that I don't think anyone would have looked askance at if it was something that came out of a face-to-face class in a top university. So I think it's important not to diminish the online experience in this way.
Andy Dambenko, yeah, go ahead.
I agree, and I enjoy that. I don't know if this is a discussion or a debate, but as a slightly cranky type, I recognize that this is how students relate to one another and how they create their social networks and interactions. That is, that they do it mostly online. I'm just not convinced that that's entirely a desirable thing. I'm not sure that it doesn't have some negative consequences for how they relate to other people and how the reality of other people's experience actually strikes them when they are confronted with a face-to-face situation. I'm not convinced that we necessarily want to go further in that direction. I think we might want to preserve educational institutions as spaces that give students a different kind of experience from what they normally are accustomed to.
Andy Dambenko, let me bring you back to one of the very first questions I asked about your comments in the opening pages of the book about getting to Columbia about 25 years ago and having this debate about should we keep need-blind admissions. When you look forward, when you look at how expensive college is and that it doesn't, that increasing costs, you would think it would slow down, but it doesn't seem to be slowing down. What do you think about need-blind admission going forward? What do you think about the ability of places like Columbia and Yale and Harvard to keep lower-class people, middle-class people, upper-class people all together in a kind of representative community?
Well, again, it's a complicated question. I'll say something blunt and possibly inappropriate. I think that many of our elite and wealthiest institutions should be somewhat ashamed of themselves for how little they have done to open the door of access to gifted students who may need a little extra help when they get to college and come from families where nobody's been to college before. So I think actually the institutions we've been talking mainly about are the ones that are best positioned to serve the less affluent and that they ought to do a better job of it. The larger question is whether the society at large can make the decision to reinvest in education for everyone. And reference was made to the tiered system that we have in this country, the great California public university system, from the community colleges to the state colleges to the research universities, that provided virtually universal access to higher education to every high school graduate. That system is in disarray, if not shambles, because of the tax policies of the last 25 years and the economic retrenchment. So we need to confront that problem. Now, Daphne's vision, and I applaud it, and I hope it will come true, that the new technologies will be maybe not a solution to this problem, but will help to ameliorate the problem by bringing knowledge and educational opportunity to people who couldn't afford to attend a residential college. It's a great vision. But I also think there's a danger here of further stratification. The president of Arizona State University, for instance, Mike Crow, recently put it this way: we don't want a future where rich kids are taught by professors and poor kids are taught by computers. That's a stark way of putting it, but I think we have to be aware that this revolution or tsunami or whatever it is going to have big effects on less wealthy institutions. It's going to have big effects on the future of the faculty. I fear that we're moving in a direction where the privileged will get more and the less privileged will get less.
And Pratik Tandon, the final question to you here. Do you think other countries, developing countries, look at the American system and think, you know, there is a danger of this stratification and we're not going to fall into that trap? Or do you think they're on the same road that we've been on?
Well, I think they're thinking very hard about this question of how to ensure the equality of opportunity so that able and talented students are not being excluded from the system because of long-term disadvantage or inequities in access. So they're looking at this inclusiveness challenge in a couple of different ways. One is in terms of financing. So a lot of countries are instituting more variable fee structures. So that different fees can be charged to different students, but also across different departments and different courses. And they're being combined with income contingent loans that can provide another kind of cross-subsidization and to help ensure equity. Now, Australia has done this very, very well, and it's been a big success in this category. And the UK is trying to do it now. And I think that there are some lessons to be learned from there. There is very complex instruments in terms of how to control costs, and they require generally a very large upfront public investment to finance these types of schemes. But around the world, they've been shown to have been successful.
A really interesting discussion and debate about revolutionizing college from where we learn to how we learn. I've been speaking with Andrew DelBanco, professor of American Studies at Columbia and the author of College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. Daphne Koller, professor of computer science at Stanford and a founder of Coursera, which offers free online courses. And Pratik Tandon, an economist at the World Bank. Thanks to all of you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kara. Nice to be with you.
Well, for all the news coverage that the fiscal cliff negotiations have gotten, the fate of farms has never really made it into the spotlight. Remember the Farm Bill? No? The legislation that establishes our agriculture and hunger policy? Well, what exactly happened to it on January 1st? Kelly Crossley is going to be bringing you that story. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.